Previously.tv Podcast Network.
Addiction is the son of a bitch. And I need to stop the cycle now. Because I don't want my kids looking in a casket.
Showtime enters a tragically crowded subgenre with its five-part series, The Trade. The trade in question? Puffy stickers! Alas, no. It's drugs. Eve Beatty joins me to see if filmmaker Matthew Heineman brings anything new to the topic, and whether the Mythbusters and PBS can convince us an escape from Alcatraz was possible. It's The Blotter Presents, Episode 43. Hello, I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I am still a little mad that my mom goodwilled my old Alcatraz triathlon t-shirt, even though it was more whole than garment. I am joined this week by Eve Beatty. Welcome back, Eve.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Sarah.
I'm not sure you're going to be thanking me after we get done talking about our most wanted segment.
Wait, is this an intervention? No!
It could be an episode of intervention. We are discussing Showtime's The Trade, which premiered, as you're listening to this, last Friday and will be airing for the next four or five Fridays on Showtime. From Showtime's site, here's the case file. From Columbus, Ohio to Guerrero, Mexico and countless cities in between, the opioid epidemic has ravaged communities on both sides of the border. But what about the lives behind the headlines and statistics? This timely, provocative five-episode docuseries spotlights the crisis through the eyes of those most affected. The growers, addicts, cartel bosses, and law enforcement hopelessly caught in its web. I don't know if it's that timely. I feel like we're in the whatever the opposite of the golden age is of docuseries focusing on the opioid epidemic, Jesus. But this one, despite feeling like kind of a marriage between live PD and intervention, was quite affecting. Eve, what did you, first of all, how many of these do you tend to watch?
Like just in my regular life?
Yeah.
Like for fun.
Unrequired by podcasting.
You know, I don't. I don't know if you remember when we were talking about back when like previously TV was doing more text-based stuff. You guys approached me and asked me if I wanted to cover intervention. And I turned you down because I get uncomfortable with a lot of normal human emotions. But I do. Like In my day job or whatever, you know, I cover crime and stuff, and that doesn't, you know, it bothers me. Of course it bothers me, you know, sad stuff bothers me, but stuff like intervention, it, a lot of times it's just like a lot of misery and it's tough to watch. I really liked The Trade. I did find the addiction stuff, you know, which it's sort of interesting how it's sort of woven together, and we should probably talk about that a little more. I found the addiction stuff very affecting, and also it's interesting how you hear the same things again and again and again. And maybe that's one of the reasons I wasn't interested in intervention too. It's the same story again and again, and it's the same heartbreaking story again and again. It's just like the drugs change.
Yeah, pretty much. I'm going to actually skip ahead. I will note that the woman we heard up top in our first clip is an addict. Her father is an addiction counselor who has had his own struggles with alcohol, and she has just gotten done tying off with her phone charger, which you can see if you want in our visual aids for this episode, which will be on our social media channels. You can find those on Twitter and Facebook at Blotter Presents. But I am going to skip ahead to clip three because I pulled this clip. This is a different guy, but this is also literally every single intervention episode regarding heroin, and particularly their current season. where they basically...
I am so sorry.
That's quite all right. Where they basically flooded Atlanta, or the heroin triangle in Georgia, with all the interventionists, and they're just trying to, like, you know, firebomb the problem, basically. But mm-hmm. in clip three, it's like, you know, I could have written this at this point.
I never thought that I would ever be like this. A junkie. When I was younger, I was just hanging out with friends, skateboarding, you know, just normal suburban life. When I first started using, it was pain pills, you know, on the weekends, just kind of like a party thing. And I got to the point where I got addicted to pain pills, where I was using them every day. And a neighbor of mine who was already using heroin was like, listen, man, you can go spend $150 on pain pills, or you can spend $20 on a bag of heroin. So I was like, I might as well try it out.
That's Skyler. He's 24. You'll see a picture of him on our social media this week. He does not look 24. He's also living with his parents, and we do see him get kicked out of their house for coming home high. His and his brother Ryan's mom is basically running a mini methadone clinic for both of them. It's grim, but I think this is one of the things that the trade does well, is to bring it always back to what it's doing to families, even on the side of the growers and like Don Miguel in Mexico. So it's not easy to watch, but it's well done. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I do think that there's a specific focus on the law enforcement sort of side of the show, that it's definitely talking about how children are affected, but it, at least in the two episodes I saw, never felt like, oh, but what about the children? It didn't feel gimmicky. It seemed like people were, you know, the law enforcement people and the sort of the other peripheral people were genuinely just like struck again and again by the tragedy of it all, even though they've obviously seen this numerous times. Like, I think in the second clip I think that's the first time that I sort of felt that prickle of tears.
Yeah. It's grim. Yeah. Let's give that a listen.
Your mom might have dropped something.
I mean, this little teeny voice that already knows what to tell 5-0 about random powder in the car. And I mean, this is like a little kid. She's like 4.
Yeah. And the kid has like a little, like, you know, like, I think she's like got a little coloring book or something in her hands. And then later on, when the alleged supplier to the person who was being pulled over there, the home is busted. Not only is the house also filled with children and a very good dog.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned the puppy.
That was a good dog.
I know he just like runs out in the street. I'm like, can someone look after the dog?
Put a leash on that dog. Put a leash on that dog. He's in the road. But he's a good dog who I hope, you know, found a good home. And the house itself was in, you know, that same sort of horrifying disarray we see again and again when we click through on a local broadcast. It's always broadcast coverage, right? Of like children found in terrible conditions. In I think in that case, it was. Was that Dayton yet, or was that still Columbus?
I don't recall. This one was really a heartbreaker, because the parents are horrified at themselves, but at the same time just powerless to stop the cycle. It just doesn't seem like something they can do. And meanwhile, I mean, we don't hear it in this clip, but like literal filth they're living in. Like poo. Yeah. In the house, and yet that's what they know, and they're all together in what they know. So when law enforcement comes in, takes this dealer out, and then is sort of clearing the house, this is what you hear in clip four.
Come on up this
come
way.
Come on, okay? Watch your feet.
You guys, come on up this down. Way. You guys are good. Come on up
come on,
this way.
Come on, come on.
It's all right. We're the good guys.
Come on.
I don't think so.
Keep coming out this way. Keep coming out this
come
way.
Come on out.
There you go. You're good. Come on. You're fine.
Yep. Oh, God. I mean, these poor kids. And then the cops being like, you know, it's okay. We're the good guys. Like, yeah. But these kids are going to go into the system, which is already completely overloaded. Like the state of Ohio is just swallowing itself with this. And it's not the only particular region where this is a problem. The documentary about Cape Cod's extreme heroin problem, which was on HBO, was a heartbreaker. And it's the same thing. And the number of young children that are inevitably involved in this, like, I wouldn't say it was shocking in the sense that, like, not in the sense of surprise, but just, I don't know, I guess I'm glad I'm still capable of being deeply dismayed by this, but
yeah. Well, and then we're looking at this too, and we see that same sort of, you know, cycle of addiction and poverty that, you know, that we used to, I think, or maybe like, you know, associate more with large cities, where we're looking at people who are grandparents. And, you know, Sarah, you and I are around the same age. We're ladies in our mid 40s. And I think that some of these grandparents are a little bit younger than we are. And, you know, kids having kids having kids, plus, you know, this level of addiction to pills, to heroin, to, you know, the sort of the one fatality we saw in the two episodes that we watched was another parent, and that was cocaine and, once again, you know, fentanyl, which I think anybody who reads the news knows is what is truly responsible for, you know, both these low and high profile addiction deaths. Philip Seymour Hoffman, when he died, it was because there was fentanyl in his heroin. And just in case, you know, there's someone out there who doesn't get what fentanyl is, you've probably had fentanyl if you've had very minor surgery. I was ovum donor for a number of years. And when they go to do the ovum retrieval, what you get is fentanyl. And it is truly amazing. It is the drug that anesthesiologists are most likely to be addicted to. And it is just a remarkable sensation to me as someone who has never done drugs. You know, when you just feel every concern you have just magically leave when it enters your blood system. So you understand why, you know, fentanyl is being used to make these drugs feel even more appealing, to make them more addictive, and to make them a little more cost effective. But it's killing people. You know, what is it? I think they said, like, you know, that it's like a 9/11, like every day or something, you know, the number of people who are dying because of this.
Yeah. It's nuts. And then you definitely have they had a term for this in one of the excellent New Yorker articles about it. And that I believe was set in it's, you know, not fiction, but it was about a community in West Virginia where, parents of some of the victims of these addictions are sort of like banding together because it's like the government doesn't know what to do or like knows but isn't doing it or can't afford it. So the community and like the moms are sort of teaming up with the cops and everyone's like carrying Narcan around. And it's nuts. But they had a term for this like lost generation between the little kids, like the baby that we heard in clip two, and these grandparents around our age who are having to raise the whole next generation. I forget what the term was, but there's, I think, a whole like band. Like if you look at this sort of like tree ring of these communities, there's a whole band where these people in their 20s are just gone.
Yeah.
In jail, if they're lucky. We follow one detective, or really like his whole squad, but mostly him, and he's trying to work backward from the death of this woman, Ashley, to like go up the chain and bring everyone in the chain down who gave her these drugs. And then we hear from Ashley's dad over footage of the whole family putting flowers on Ashley's grave in clip 5.
You know, you go from the beginning of the story and you talk about her coming into the world and you being there for the total just joy and happiness and just the proudest parent in the world. Excuse me. The most beautiful kid. To standing over her in a bathroom, dead at 26 years old.
This guy gets me every time. We heard his 911 call about finding his daughter. He is, bereft and knows what's happening and knows he can't do anything about it. It's brutal. But I think it's really, it's good. I'm going to keep watching it. I think it's well done, but there's just something about the coverage generally. Not this specifically, which I think is trying to be as even-handed and like just document literally as much as possible. But you weren't seeing this level of like documentary special event concern about crack. And I was wondering if that was something that occurred to you while you were watching this or while you've been sort of generally contemplating the cultural focus on the opioid epidemic. Because since we are the same age, like,
yeah,
I don't know. Okay, on one hand, like I grew up in basically Mayberry, New Jersey. And anything with drugs past marijuana was like completely alien and not something that this apple polishing nerd was going to have any truck with in the mid to late 80s anyway. But this, I don't know, when people talk about how the opioid epidemic is like hitting, quote, closer to home. Mm-hmm. Well, that means it's hitting white people, so now it's a big problem. Do you have any thoughts on that? Especially since you do write about crime in your, you know, life. And
oh, well, sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that, like, you know, it's a no-brainer that the people who made the show, who I read an interesting article, which I'll send you, Sarah, to put in the show notes, about a guy, his name's Brent Kunkel, and he's from Tennessee, who's the guy who produced the law enforcement stuff, and as opposed to the stuff that's taking place in Guerrero. He sort of alludes to the fact that they made certain to make sure that a lot of the stories focused on white people too. And I don't think that was because, you know, like whatever, white people make better TV or something. I think it's because they wanted it to hit home that this is, you know, unlike crack or the ghetto drugs, which, I mean, you, since we are the same age, you remember when that was like something that was just thrown around as an acceptable term, which of course it is not, you know, as opposed to the ghetto drugs where it's separate from us, this is hitting closer to home because it's hitting, you know, Trump's America. But I don't know that we necessarily needed to be reminded of that. I mean, I think that ever since meth came along, we realized that white people did drugs.
yeah.
And so it is, you know, it is a demographic problem for me that, you know, other than one African-American police officer we see early on, the black faces we see are an upper level, upper being a very loose term, an upper level drug dealer. And then we see a lot of brown people in Mexico who are making the drugs. I c- could handle a little more diversity overall there, not just because, you know, I want to see a lot of representation on television, but also because otherwise it seems you could easily buy into the narrative that, was it Don Miguel? Don, yes. Miguel, the Pablo Escobar of Guerrero is, and they make, I think, real pains to compare him to Pablo, right? With that sort of the opening scene is him giving epiphany gifts to all of the children in the area because he never received gifts as a child. So he's definitely positioning himself as like the new Escobar. So we see, you know, the Mexicans arguably victimizing these poor, you know, Trump voters or, you know, whatever. I mean, that's not even fair because one of the heroin addicts had a Hillary t-shirt, but, you know, but the sort of the forgotten middle America people. And then here's this black guy drug dealer. So there's something about that was sort of, you know, it was making me a little bit anxious, but at the same time, if you want to tell a story and this is who you get.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, I was struck by the fact that like, there he is on camera. Cause he's like, whatever, like shit's different down here. And so you don't need to blur my face out.
Yeah. You know, what's different down there? You can get 2 liters of Doritos. Dude, we only get the bottles here. I was so psyched by that. I like paused it, took a picture, sent it to my husband. Where can we get this? Anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
New York City.
No shit. Really? Okay. Good to know. Mm-hmm.
Come over. So yeah, I was struck by that. I was struck by that. They showed like, you know, his staffer is sort of like picking poppies and they're like, so the boss got a new ride, you know, pretty cool. And like, look at all the stash spots that it had. And they're like very open about showing like where they stash drugs in a car, mm-hmm. that's crossing the border, that I was just like, okay, well, I guess you feel like that's not going to impact your business in any too negative way. And, it, you know, I don't think the show wants us to necessarily think one thing or the other about Don Miguel, who is himself at pains to point out that he is the only viable industry.
Yeah.
So he can run it or they can all get run over by someone else, which starts to happen. And that's also hideous, you know, like this woman carrying a cross to her husband's grave and just weeping that she's like, I can't make it. I can't walk anymore. I'm too sad. Like, ugh. I mean, but again, like I'm not sure I can judge Don Miguel because someone's going to run that business and there's no other way to feed your family.
Well, and I wish that someone would sort of make the connection, which, you know, it can't be Narcos. Narcos is obviously a fictionalized account, and it's very handy to have, you know, the voiceover of the DEA guy basically saying again and again, well, the reason that Pablo Escobar was able to get the foothold he was is because Americans wanted drugs. You know, nobody is coming up from Mexico and shoving drugs in your vein.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so the reason that this industry exists is because there's this insatiable American demand for it. In the same way that the reason that, you know, iPhone factories where people are in, you know, terrible shape exist is because of American demands for it, or, you know, Old Navy t-shirts or whatever else.
Yeah. And there's definitely a parallel that they don't underline, but which is clear, or it was to me, between, you know, Don Miguel or, you know, this guy who was killed, sort of that these are the dangers of this, mm-hmm. life, and the family that we saw, you know, my kids are in there and the little kid is wailing for her father. Like, her dad became a dealer to support his own habit. And because in the middle of Ohio, ain't other shit going on. Like, even minor league baseball is like, bye and move to Indiana. Like, it's bad. And it's too bad. It's a nice little state, Ohio. I'm a fan, but there's just nothing. There's nothing left. They got the, you know, there's like the NBA. There's like LeBron and there's heroin and there's fighting heroin. And, you know, I don't have the answers, but I thought that parallel was well done. But it's always a little bothersome to me watching series and projects like this and realizing that if it were flipped in time, that you would not be seeing, I don't think, this level of interest in the way crack was just, you know, punching Newark and particularly Camden, New Jersey in the tits for like five straight years.
No, crack was sexy. Didn't you see New Jack City?
That's right. It was. Oof.
Yeah.
So, yeah, let's close this section with a clip from the second episode, which I found interesting because I thought their take on law enforcement's just sort of like frustration and running in place with this problem and the Hydra that they're confronted with was good. And I thought that the fact that they left this argument in was telling. So here's clip six.
This is why I know that.
Well, that's why you do your initial interview. That's what I'm saying.
I'm not ready to talk to him right now. I'm not talking to him.
I'm not trying to be a dick. I'm just telling you that.
Jake, I'm not going. Damn, dude. Okay. I'm not rushing shit.
Okay. I'm not. You just want to press him and interrogate him.
No, I don't. I want to have more information. I am not going to fuck this case up. Let me wait.
Okay. That is fine.
Just, I don't know. Like the little, you know, Jake and this other guy are like work spouses basically in the police cruiser. And, I liked that. I thought it was good. The not Jake detective is, I think, you know, he has a lot of voiceovers about how he has a family now and he's taking it personally. And you get the sense that the show thinks maybe he's a little too close to all of this. But yeah.
That said, he's a skilled interrogator. And I think that, you know, if there was anything that I learned from watching this show, it's that whole thing where people are resistant to flipping on their supplier is a total myth, because they'd say, so who gave you the drugs? And they'd say, here's his name, here's his address, here's everything, like right off the bat.
Yeah. And he was very smart about, he's also like, look, that might have been Jake, who was like, assume that we already have the answers to some of these questions and we're trying to figure out how helpful you're going to be.
Yeah.
Like I do. And you see that actually on, what's it called? The First 48, where they're like, they've pulled in some of these people enough times on other charges that there is this collegial, like business-like tone to the proceedings. That it's like, look, we all know what's happening here. So are you going to give me this name or are you going to waste my time? And 9 times out of 10, out comes the name. Like, it's not this, you know, it's not this fictionalized, like, I want a lawyer. Like, they do, but then they're like, all right, here's what's happening, which is refreshing, at least to me.
Yeah.
So do you think you're going to continue watching this? I don't know if you actually have Showtime, but...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Of course I have Showtime. Or at least I have a password. Yeah, I think I am, because I think that, you know, we have hit on some of sort of the harder elements of the show and the more sort of distressing elements of the show, but it is, to me, very engrossing. And the episodes that I watched really whipped by for me. So I think, you know, unless it does something to piss me off, I'm going to keep watching, because I kind of want to know, it seems like they're following these people. I want to see how this stuff, the little personal stories turn out.
Yeah, I think her name is Heather. The young lady that we heard from at the top of the episode.
Yeah.
Brittany. Yes. Sorry, Brittany. Brittany ends up in jail. And then, but this is seen as sort of a good thing, I think, by everyone involved, including her. And then she has a pretty interesting exchange in the courtroom with the judge, who has seen.
Loved that.
A gazillion of these cases. And, so I sort of want to see how, like, she gets, you know, 90 days with some time served, and then, you know, she's like, I'm going to sober living, and I'm interested to see what becomes of her as the episodes go by. So I know everybody's kind of inundated with this, but if you're only going to watch one of these, this is really well put together. It's a broad range of, like, it's the whole spectrum of the experience of, you know, being in this drugs web, whether you're making it or taking it. So yeah, I'd recommend it. And now, for a much lighter-hearted take on crime, it's our cold case section. Not that prison breaks are, you know, a laugh a minute, but this is absolutely the most famous one, and we are going to take a look at two different properties that test whether it's possible for the Alcatraz 3 to have escaped. Eve, you suggested this as our cold case topic based on some recent news in the case. Would you like to fill us in?
Yes. My friends at a local CBS affiliate here in San Francisco somehow came across a letter that was sent to San Francisco's Richmond District Police Station in 2013. And the letter in part reads, "My name is John Anglin. I escaped from Alcatraz in June 1962 with my brother Clarence and Frank Morris. I'm 83 years old and in bad shape. I have cancer. Yes, we all made it that night, but barely." He goes on in the letter to say that if he can get a promise from the feds that he'll only serve a year in prison and get medical attention, he'll write back and let them know where he is. If there isn't a more devastating commentary on the healthcare system in America, I don't know what it could be. But
immediate thought when I read that story, which you can find a link in our show notes, of course.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, the validity of this letter is obviously, this is a letter that, like I said, was sent in 2013 and just sort of came to light now. I'm not sure how, but, you know, you get a lot of letters when you work at the police station. You know, the feds looked at it and they said it's inconclusive. They, you know, DNA tested it. They fingerprint tested it. You know, the U.S. Marshals are, as we saw on the PBS episode, still sort of, you know, it's a cold case for them. There's, you know, they're keeping an eye on it. But, you know, the fact remains that these guys, if they're still alive, Frank Morris would be 90. John and Clarence would be 86 and 87, respectively. So especially if that was John and he had cancer back in 2013, things don't look good that we're going to find these guys alive. But it is one of those things, right, that we keep thinking, well, maybe they made it.
Yeah. I mean, it just makes, like, Occam's razor suggests that, first of all, that no matter how faithfully you try to recreate the conditions, you're never going to be 100% sure that you got everything right. And also, you're not going to be using the same raincoats, and maybe the tides are a little different. Mm-hmm. But you can never quite rule it out because we just don't know. Like, we can say to, like, 95% sure they didn't make it. But the Mythbusters took a crack at it. And based on this footage, this is like a pretty early myth that they took on.
It's a season one, episode 8. It aired in December 2003.
So, yeah, we're going back. Going back a minute, here in clip 7 is my old friend Adam celebrating not having drowned.
We made it!
Given a reasonable amount of intelligence, I think it's entirely possible that they made it. Again, I think the most damning evidence that they didn't is the fact that no one's heard from them since.
Unless they find any specific evidence that these guys, you know, lived happily ever after or something after they got ashore, you know, we won't know whether it was true or not, but we know that it could have been done, which is cool.
Oh, Jamie, never change. This was a really fun, we'll link to this segment in the show notes also. This is a really fun segment, and I love that both this and PBS's Secrets of the Dead, which we will be talking about next, went to the same, like, scale model tidal table of San Francisco Bay, which the next time I'm in the Bay Area, I want to find a way to visit that thing. It's so cool.
We can arrange this, Sarah. It is. It is so cool, and it's huge. I think they mentioned on Mythbusters that it's more than an acre in size, but, you know, it is something that people use to try to figure out where a body's going to end up or where it came from.
And the little rafts that each team mm-hmm. makes respectively out of, like, paper clips and post-its and, like, a little, I think the Mythbusters used, like, a little Adobe pad. And it's just like, I don't know. It's really cool. So yeah, the Mythbusters, it's a very economical, it's like a 5-minute segment. Secrets of the Dead is 51 minutes and it involves a Dutch team that just wanted to figure out how this could have been done. And frankly, I think just kind of wanted a United States vacay. And this like boat expert slash set builder who all team up to see if this can be done. And they're going to try to recreate the exact conditions the same as the Mythbusters did. But here's the boat enthusiast slash prop maker on how he's contributing to this, experiment in clip 8.
My day job currently is I make glittery elves, but I've always loved boats. I've always been, you know, a sailor since I was a little kid.
The raft needs to be more than just buoyant. They want to build a raft as close to the original as possible.
It would be nice to see how they made their raft, whether they stitch it or not.
What kind of glue they use.
Exactly.
This episode, I don't watch this show a lot, but whenever I do, it's usually for this, and it's always delightful. Like, I really love PBS shows' ability to take you through like solid science and proper experimentation and like not jazz it up, but not dumb it down either. And so their recreation of the conditions I thought was cool and entertaining.
Well, and I think that, you know, it's like you think about Alcatraz or you've seen The Rock or whatever, and or maybe you've even like visited San Francisco and you've taken the boat out there and you think, well, it doesn't seem that far, right? You know, people do that thing where you swim from Alcatraz to Aquatic Park, which is like by Fisherman's Wharf if you've just visited here, and they do it and it's no big deal. So it does seem like, oh, you know, well, how hard could it really be? But in actuality, the tides are insane. Like, even if you had like a real boat, you know, that like somebody made not in a prison, and you were just trying to paddle from that side of Alcatraz, you start getting into the tides and where you go and what happens. And I cannot overstate enough the point that they make on the PBS show that if you end up in your boat going past Golden Gate Bridge, you are so screwed. This is something that regularly they have to deal with here in San Francisco, where people go under the Golden Gate Bridge in their little sailboats or whatever and end up in the Pacific. The Golden Gate Bridge is sort of the border between the San Francisco Bay and the for real ocean. And once you're on the Pacific and you're in just some little boat, like, you are going to have a lot of trouble getting back to safety because the ocean gets really rough right on the other side of the Big Orange Bridge.
Yeah, I thought that they did a great job explaining how the tides work, but without getting too granular about it for people who are not harbor masters and don't know the terms. I thought they did a great job explaining how it came to be that, well, first of all, the role of the fourth man, West, I guess his name was. The role of the fourth man, and also just like how these things happen generally. Like, eventually, you sort of like literally let your guard down a little bit, I guess. And like, people have privileges, they're doing work, they hung up some blankets. We didn't look back there. What could he be doing? Let's listen to clip 9 for a little of that psychology.
Normally they would put a guard with him at all times, but he said, I'll just go and check on him now and then. Not a good idea. Not with an Alcatraz convict. You're there, everyone was under the gun 24 hours a day.
But then there was no guard here watching him.
No, the feeling seems to have been once he was let up here and he was locked in, you know, what could he possibly do? Where could he possibly go?
I mean, they're on Alcatraz. What could possibly happen?
What could possibly go wrong?
I'd also like to note that in this scene, one of the Dutch guys is wearing, they have a couple of really great t-shirts, these guys. And his in this scene says, I void warranties, which is pretty funny to me. But we also heard from a former guard in that segment that's like, Okay, first of all, is that the origin of the phrase under the gun? Because that's interesting. But second of all, every time you read about a prison break, it's something like this, that they're like, well, but who would even try that? Like, well, they're waiting for you to, you know, they're waiting for you to just be like, oh, well, they never tried to escape before. Like, actually, the Anglins were on Alcatraz because of repeated escape attempts. Isn't that, wasn't that their whole thing? They were all just trying to dig out. See,
all three of these guys were like, and I think that that's one of the reasons that it's fun to sort of root for them. These guys were not convicted of, or as far as I know, accused of any homicides, rape, anything like that. And bank robbers do have that sort of, you know, if you're, like, think about every bank robbery movie you've ever seen where it's like, no, we're not going to kill anyone, right? Yeah, that's great. Now it's fun. It's Inside Man. It's wonderful.
Yes.
You know, so, like, bank robbers, I think, are beloved in American culture. And then, you know, that the bank robbers perhaps managed to escape, I think is one of the reasons that this myth has been, maybe it's true, has been so enduring. It's fun to think about that. And it is also fun to think about these guards sort of, you know, relaxing. To your earlier point, when we were talking about the trade, it all does become collegial. You know, you are all sort of there and one guy's on one side and one guy's on the other side, but you can't be constantly at war for decades. You know, it just, it doesn't make sense. You know, people aren't built that way. You're going to go insane. And I do think that that's when you start to slip. And we have seen, you know, how people escape. It's not that, I mean, obviously no one's building boats, but that's what happens is the guards get relaxed.
Yeah. And what we also like to think is that if we were in prison unjustly, a la the show Prison Break, that that it is possible to get out, that ingenuity and careful planning means that you can, you know, rise above your circumstances, in this case, literally floating away from them. And that if you work hard enough and you think smart enough, that this is possible. And this next clip both shows respect to, like, even if they sort of drowned, like, I don't know, 200 yards away from the rock, or they did escape and somehow kept their mouths shut for decades, which, spoiler, that never happens. They're dead. Sorry. But that the end of the clip has this delightful jazzy Ocean's 11, like, montage-y music of them in their workshop, like, finishing the raft, that I think really speaks to your point you just made about bank robbers being not like the warm and fuzzy criminals, but like much more relatable and aspirational than the Birdman of Alcatraz, who actually, except for the ornithology, was a real shit brick. Anyway, here is clip 10.
All right. I think we can build a raft. I think it's going to leak like a freaking sieve, and we're going to spend the entire time pumping it up. Hell, you could probably even blow into it fast enough. I have more respect for them after attempting the work myself, you know, relatively ideal conditions. If I need more glue, I can go get more glue. I don't have to sneak it in from the cafeteria. No one's gonna shoot me, probably. So, and I'm having trouble. I don't think we're fitting three people in this thing.
If they are my size, it will fit.
What are you saying? Saying too much pizza? All right.
I mean, I love it. Like, whoever told the Secrets of the Dead composer, like, and now you get to have a little fun instead of just foreboding strings of these three scientists are about to drown in the Pacific. So yeah, that was delightful. I like that this episode has a sense of humor about things and isn't the customary History Channel, like, just overwrought hand-wringing about mysterious Christmas cards that basically prove nothing. So I'm excited to go back in the Secrets of the Dead archives and watch more stuff. And I'm also satisfied that these experiments may not prove really anything except that it's possible to do the experiment. Here's clip 11.
Okay. All right. Get the raft in.
Stay fast!
close. Okay, I'm calling it. They're dead.
Oh, I mean, I love that guy. He was really not happy about making this announcement either, as he was being keel hauled over the side of the little tugboat that came to rescue them. what is your feeling on the Alcatraz 3? Fish food?
Well, I mean, it's not easy. Marin County is the tough place to get to by boat, but I never fail to be amazed at what human beings can accomplish. And, you know, given enough time and enough focus. So I think it's, would I put money on it? No. But I believe that that's more possible than a lot of things that people really believe in, like God and stuff. So, you know, it seems possible to me. And no one has proven that it is completely impossible to my satisfaction.
Yeah, I always love watching this experiment that's like, look, this was extremely difficult to do, but we have evidence that suggests that everything that's part of this experiment happened. So it was difficult, but actually the odds of it getting done were pretty good. Like, they did escape. They did get to the water. Like, they did the hard part, kind of. And I didn't clip this, but they point out slightly after our last clip that it's like, look, they had been waiting for this moment and planning for this moment. And they knew as well as anyone that if they got swept under the bridge, they were toast. So the surge of adrenaline could have saved them. Like, I think it was definitely doable. But I'm a, you know, big believer in human nature, and I just don't think that if they all made it, they all kept their mouths shut about it. Just don't. And also,
well, and that's one of the things that the feds have said too, with, you know, the sort of the revelations regarding this letter, is that, you know, it's, I think the line is like, it's completely impossible that these people became a law-abiding citizens. And I think that they, you know, that's the sort of attitude that makes someone become a fed, is that you don't believe in the human being's ability to change. But I don't know that that aspect of it. I think that you can be a criminal and decide to live a quiet life, or maybe just get better at bank robbing and not get caught.
That's also possible. But yeah, this sort of reminds me of the numerous tweets that I've been seeing on my respective timelines about, you know, DB Cooper and this, like, I love that they're calling themselves an independent commission and being like, the fact that the FBI won't give us the time of day means that we're onto something. I'm like, maybe, except no, yeah. It doesn't. Your boy's not Robert Rackstraw. We're never going to know. Please stop. But that's another one. Why do people love that story? Because they still haven't solved this goddamn skyjacking, and it's been almost 50 years. Like, I mean, I get it. Like, I never get sick of material about those cases just because it's possible. One smart guy against the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, Secrets of the Dead, thumbs up. Once again, there will be a link to that as well in the show notes. You can watch it on pbs.org. Before we wrap this up, Eve, where else can listeners find you and your work?
Well, right now I'm on a little bit of a hiatus regarding my written work, but I do own a store in San Francisco. If you're ever in town, I urge you to come visit. We're in the Outer Sunset, just a few blocks from Ocean Beach, which, you know, if you pass the Golden Gate Bridge and keep going in your little boat, you'll see Ocean Beach in the distance right before you drown. the store is called Avenues Dry Goods. That's what we are on all our social media. And we're right there waiting for you to come in and take a look at our locally made goods, which are so much nicer than the, the made in China shot glasses you'll find down at a Fisherman's Wharf.
I can personally vouch for the Coit Tower Space Invaders t-shirt, and
thank you.
If I may suggest, if you're looking for a new design for a t-shirt, Alcatraz Triathlon, And a nice
I have been
poly.
Trying to convince Tim, my husband, who we designed the shirts together, to do some sort of Alcatraz-y thing for a long time. And so far, he has not been pleased with anything. Creatives, they're difficult to appease.
All right, well, I'll pitch some things with stick figures. I'm sure that I can win him over.
Thank you.
Thanks again, Eve, for visiting us on The Blotter Presents. Once again, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at Blotter Presents. I'm Sarah D. Bunting. I'm your host, and you can find me on Twitter at Tomato Nation. Coming up soon, Love and Hate Crime, Unsolved, and Wormwood. Is it Wormwood? Yes, it's Wormwood. Or we'll fix this in post. We will talk to you next time on The Blotter Presents.
In a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.